brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
SoftRep.com, on time, on target. I am Ian Scotto. I'm fresh off of my birthday weekend, which was fun. If you're wondering what I did, I got to go see Lynyrd Skynyrd on the Last of the Street Survivors farewell tour with my dad, with my good friend Stevie D. And man, it was a great time. I think there's probably a big cross-section, I would think, of this audience and Skynyrd fans. I know there are just like rock fans in general and metal fans and all that from my years of doing this. I've seen Skynyrd, you know, the current lineup. Yes, of course, we all know that it is not the band that people know from the 70s in terms of lineup, but I've seen the current lineup. I actually did get to see the original piano player, Billy Powell, years ago. But for the fourth time, I believe this was the fourth time, and it was awesome. The only thing that's kind of funny to me is that, you know, going into it, I was saying to my dad and my friend Steve, I'm like, this is the last time you're ever going to see Skynyrd again, unless you want to travel to one of the other dates. But this is the last time they're ever playing New York or Long Island, my area. And I have to be honest, it was a great time, but it didn't really feel like a farewell tour. And it made me think that they may be right. Like, my dad is convinced you'll be seeing them come out a year from now again and touring again. I mean, if that's the case, it's a pretty good marketing gimmick on their part, because they, when they usually play New York or they play Long Island, they play the NYCB Theater, which is really more known, you know, everything's commercial now, but is the Westbury Music Fair, legendary venue. I read Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys book, and like, he talks about that being a legendary venue they played and stuff. But I was looking it up, and that's where they usually play, where I've seen them every other time. And that is a capacity of 2,870 people. All right. In comparison, they played Jones Beach Theater the other night, 15,000 people, nearly sold out looking around. And when they play NYCB Theater, I don't even think that's sold out. So it's like, when people hear Farewell Tour, they come out. So, you know, it's weird. In a way, I hope it is their farewell tour, because, you know, that's what they're selling. But at the same time, like, they still have it. The current lineup is great. So I guess the bottom line is, if you are in an area that they happen to be playing, I would definitely suggest you go. I had a really great time, and you will too. I mean, if you love their music, so... really cool seeing the Last of the Street Survivors tour. You know, but I compare that, by the way, when I talk about the farewell thing, with when Motley Crue did their farewell tour. Like, I am convinced that is the last time you'll ever see Motley Crue tour. And every night that they played Home Sweet Home, you saw like a tear in their eye, and they referenced that, like, this is the last time we're ever going to play this venue. There wasn't a whole lot of that with Skynyrd on stage. Anyway, we have Craig Grossi coming on this show, and it's, yeah, solo show in terms of my hosting. Last show, though, was kind of a solo Jack show. I mean, I happened to be here. I was recording, but I probably had a mic time of maybe 3 or 5 minutes. And you guys probably want us to cover the response to that Woke Vets show, Task and Purpose. But maybe we'll do that next time, because there's nothing for me to really address. It's really a Jack Murphy issue that he got into, and I am kind of on the outside of it. I thought it was an interesting show and covered a lot of ground, and definitely made me aware of some things that I didn't know. But in terms of responding to the positive feedback, the negative feedback, I just honestly don't have much to say. I'm an outsider in that situation, but I hope you guys enjoyed it. And yeah, so just going to be me with Craig this episode because Jack is out with his daughter. His daughter is ending the school year. And Jack is a guy who spends a lot of time with his daughter, which is great. So he's out today. We would have recorded this a different day, but this just worked for Craig. So hopefully you guys will enjoy this. This is a really heartwarming story of a Marine, a stray dog, and how they rescued each other, as the title says of the book, Craig and Fred. And if you're a dog lover, which I am, I think you'll really enjoy this. Or if you have kids, there's a young reader's edition, which we'll get into. So this might be a book that you want them to check out if, you know, your kids love dogs and you want them to read something that's in the veteran category. Before we bring on Craig, I want to let you guys know, as I always do, there's only one club out there with gear handpicked by special operations military veterans from several branches, and that, of course, is Crate Club. Past items we've had in our crates, Emerson knives, a Blackhawk industrial medical pouch, and I should notice, I was just on the phone with Scott Whitner. We tweeted out or Instagrammed out a picture of this watch that we're going to do exclusively for Crate Club premium members, and we're teaming up with NFW watches for it, and this thing is going to look badass. So it's not out yet, but if you sign up for the premium club, you're going to see it a few months down the line, I believe. So sign up now for that. That's going to be a really cool item, especially when you have the guys at Crate Club giving their assessment of these watches, because I know Scott Whitner is a big watch guy. Brandon Webb is a huge watches guy, and they're not going to put anything in that crate that they're not happy with. So as I mentioned, that's the premium crate. We have different tiers depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. We get such great feedback from people who listen to this podcast and then sign up for Crate Club. So hopefully you come on board and you join. It's at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. For you dog owners in the audience, check this out. You're going to love this. And by the way, I'm going to tell Craig Grossi about Kuna because he's going to love it. We've just partnered with Kuna. They have a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog every month of healthy treats, training aids, and you know, one of those training aids or supplements is the probiotic we've been putting in there, and it seems to be having a great impact on the health of dogs. And it's important. You want these dogs there with you and their longevity. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and they not only promote a healthy diet but also promote being active with your dog. So whether we're talking a pit bull or a chihuahua, this is just what you're looking for. You can see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you. Your dog will appreciate it as well, of course. And that's spelled CUNA.DOG. Also, as a reminder for those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel. Now is the time to check it out because on the horizon, in a couple of weeks, we have a brand new Inside the Team Room Intel edition with some great names that you're all familiar with. You can check that all out. You can check out Training Cell, our premiere show, which follows Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. And you can watch it all by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. That's only $4.99 a month. So that's what we have going on here at Hurricane Group. If you want to check out our website and see everything else going on, including like the book club, it's hurricane.media, hurricane.media, and you can see everything that we're up to. Joining us for the first time on Soft Rep Radio, Craig Grossi, an 8-year Marine Corps veteran, Purple Heart recipient, and Georgetown University grad. Craig is the author of Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other, which I have right in front of me. And you also did a young reader's edition, which I think is cool. You don't see that a lot. And I feel like this is one of those stories that no matter what age group, people are going to love.
Yeah, absolutely. That was actually the publisher's kind of protocol. I think whenever HarperCollins can do that, they always try to make two copies. So for me, it wasn't that much extra duty to just kind of take out some of the Marine talk and some of the different situations that were maybe a little bit more adult. But I'm really proud of the kids version of the young reader too, because it does maintain a lot of the harder kind of scenarios and the more difficult stuff that we had to deal with over there. It's opened up a whole new kind of set of obviously an audience, but also just like my fellow veterans have reached out to me and said, you know, I'm having conversations with my kid, you know, cause we're reading the book side by side, and I wasn't sure how I was going to talk to, you know, my child about this, you know, these situations that, you know, we faced and stuff. And they're able to, through our story, kind of do that. And that's just incredible. I could have never anticipated that. It's really cool.
That's great. I mean, the book in general is selling tremendously. I've seen just through on Amazon and everything. And it's a great story to get out there. Because I'm wondering with the Young Readers Edition, like, I don't think there's any Marine Corps author book that doesn't have a few four-letter words. So it was like that type of thing where I haven't read the whole book yet. I don't know if there was stuff you had to censor and take out of there.
It was a little, my biggest concern was just making sure that the important parts of the story were intact, you know, and you can take an F-bomb and make it a, you know, a heck or
exactly,
a darn,
yeah,
you know, or whatever, and it's not a big deal. The voice, my voice is still there, and Fred's, you know, everything about Fred, and also just talking about the guys that we lost and my friends that were killed, and I want kids and everyone to be able to hear their story, you know, and hear about just not just them, you know, everybody that we encountered, all the Marines that I worked with, and all the incredible stuff that they just did kind of on a daily basis.
Which, by the way, I should point out there, you can curse on this show, so feel free.
Okay, nice.
But before we get into the book itself and you know, you meeting Fred in Afghanistan in 2010, I would love to hear just the backstory of you becoming a Marine, what inspired you to join the Marines, and your story of growing up, which I know you get into in the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so you want me to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, for me, there's a lot of things that drew me to the Marine Corps. We don't have a history of Marines in my family. My dad was an Air Force guy for a little while, but I grew up in the Beltway of DC, and so the military and the government was kind of all around me. And I just remember that in high school at some point, they had one of those career days where they have all the branches come in and talk about why you should join the Army or the Navy or the Air Force or the Coast Guard. And they all got up on stage, and each one had a little pitch, you know, and they handed out pamphlets and all these different incentives and stuff. And then the Marine got up on stage, and he didn't have a slideshow. He didn't have pamphlets, you know, he wasn't selling anything. He just looked around the auditorium at like the couple hundred kids that were there and was like, maybe three or four of you have what it takes to be a Marine. If you think you're one of them, come talk to me. And he got off the stage. Like, for whatever reason, that nailed me, man, because I was really frustrated as pretty much my entire youth with school. And I was putting in a lot of work in school, but my grades weren't a reflection of that. And it was always really frustrating for me because I've been an athlete and a hockey player my whole life. And one of the things I guess I really loved about sports was the more work you put in, the better team you make, the more ice time you get, you know, and like you could see this tangible kind of result. But with school, I was like staying after school. I was in like learning disability, like classes and like all this extra shit. But my grades were like C's and D's. And so with the Marine Corps, it seemed like this place where it was like sports. It was like if you were fastest and the strongest and you worked the hardest, like they would recognize it. And it seemed like a group of people that like you joined the Marine Corps for the right reasons. Like it wasn't because, you know, you just wanted something at the end of the road. Like you wanted to be a Marine. And it's, you know, it is, there is like always going to be that kind of sales pitchness to that kind of mantra, but when I was a 17-year-old kid, that was exactly what I wanted to hear. And I wanted to be held accountable. I wanted to be a part of an organization that wasn't going to let me slip by, you know, and really hold me to these high standards. And everybody around me would essentially be better than me, you know, in a lot of ways. And I wanted to try and be, you know, be the best I could. And it was a letdown my first 4 years. I didn't exactly sign up to be a prison guard, but that's how I spent my first four. but I love being a Marine. I didn't really like working in Guantanamo Bay, and it's kind of sitting on a fence for 12 hours a day. So when I re-upped and did my second four, I found human intelligence and counter-intel, and that was what I was meant to do in the Marine Corps. I loved that job.
I could fully relate to what you're saying with the school stuff. There was a recent guest who talked about this on the other podcast I work on, Power and Thought. And it's true that school by design is about conformity, in that you can't do school your own way. You know, if you want to be an entrepreneur or a business leader, and you have the drive to succeed in that, they don't give a shit if you're great at math, if you know history and all that stuff. And with school, you have to have this wide array of different knowledge. You have to be good at memorizing, which I'm not. Maybe you're not as well. And it sounds like if you have that certain athletic ability and drive, the Marine Corps is something that would make total sense for you. So I get that.
Yeah. I felt right at home right away. It's an interesting path, because that my if you'd asked me during my first 4 years and I was sitting in a brig or, you know, just sitting on a guard post, I was internally really frustrated. But those experiences and that first 4 years has come in handy time and time again in my life, and also in my second 4 years in the Marine Corps as a human intel officer, dealing with and learning how to be an interrogator, and just being familiar with, you know, correctional environment and just people's behavior when they're being confined and stuff like that. That was huge. So it's just funny how you can be so frustrated with your current circumstances, but down the road, those circumstances are going to pay off in big ways. You just have to kind of be open to it.
I'm curious now, working as a prison guard at Guantanamo, and, you know, you don't have to get political if you don't feel like, but, you know, it's obviously an extremely controversial issue that military guys, civilians are very split on how things were handled and, you know, how we should go about capturing terrorists. I'm just wondering your experience, you know, in whatever way that you want to put it, of working there.
Yeah, I mean, it was tricky, man, and I don't know how we could have done it any other way. I mean, that I'm not trying to be unpolitical or just skirt it at all, but it was such a tricky time. And you could definitely tell, I was there in 04 and 05, and you could definitely tell there were a lot of people there that didn't belong there, that were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or just got caught up in something, and they were just like, what the heck happened, you know? And but what I think a lot of people don't know is that for every, like, there was one team of intel analysts and interrogators and prosecutors that were trying to prove that the detainees that were there belonged there. And there was an entirely other team, equally staffed and abled, that were trying to prove why they weren't supposed to be there. And for every plane that load of coming in, we had one going out, getting people home, you know, and that, you know, sorting it out. I think a lot of people, it's one of those places that has gotten this really negative image, and in a lot of situations, in a lot of cases, rightfully so. But there's just, you know, it's kind of a convenient place that we're in now, where we can look back and criticize it. And that's, you know, that's what we should always do. We should always find where we went wrong, you know, in anything. So we can move forward and get it right the next time. But there wasn't, you know, there was a lot of good going on down there too. And there was a lot, you know, a lot of concern for making sure that we had the right people that belong there.
Yeah, and so there's truly been no real easy solution on this, because every time it gets brought up of bringing these guys back to the U.S., it gets shot down, because every congressman says, I don't want these detainees in my district.
Right.
So, a lot of the people who are quick to criticize it, they don't have any real good solution. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've experienced this, because Jack Murphy talked about it in a recent show, but he was saying, you know, and Jack served the same places that you did as a Army Ranger and Green Beret. But he said that, you know, regardless of people's feelings on Guantanamo, the stuff that he saw Iraqis do to their fellow Iraqis,
he was
like, it was beyond anything going on at Guantanamo. Dude,
insane. No, part of our job was, I mean, I was a Lance Corporal when I was at Gitmo. So I was like, you know, just doing the, you know, like just, I was handling detainees every day. And one of our jobs, if you weren't on a cell block for the day, was to be on escort duty, and you were busy. You were taking them to dental appointments and medical appointments. We were taking tumors out of these guys that they didn't even know they had and extending their life by decades, you know,
no one writes about that.
No. And it was always a joke down there, you know, that we would say about, and I think a lot of the like little shops in the PX and stuff would sell t-shirts that, at the time, I don't know if they would do that now, but they were like, it was like a detainee in like his orange jumpsuit, like relaxing in a beach chair, like drinking a drink, you know, and like, we called it like Club Gitmo, you know, that was our little joke. I wish I'd gotten one of those shirts.
But yeah, man, moving on to the book itself, but I was curious about that. So in 2010, you met Fred in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Take us back to it.
Oh man. Just going back to my first four and how kind of frustrated I was and with my time in the Marine Corps, I finally, after getting through human intel training and all that, I finally found my place, and, I'm headed to Afghanistan, but it's another kind of unknown, because I'm on my way, but I don't know what I'm going to do when I get there. I still haven't been assigned as a, you know, because as an intel dude, you can do a lot of stuff, and I hadn't been assigned to a specific unit yet, and so I was kind of, you know, a little nervous about. I was worried I would end up working in a detention facility again, or, you know, just kind of chilling on Leatherneck. That would have drove me nuts. So I was there. We got to Leatherneck, and I was there for about a week, and Recon put it out that they needed an intel guy, and I made it a point to be in the best shape that I could during the workup for the deployment. Like, me and my buddy PJ were doing like 2 days at the gym and just like running a lot and just getting in our very best shape, so that if something came down for an action unit like Recon, or even if an infantry unit needed a head guy, that our CEO would think of us first. Because if nothing else, we'd be able to at least keep up on their ops. And I'd always had a lot of respect for Recon, and just kind of quietly had always wanted to be a Recon guy, but that wasn't in the cards for me. But so the opportunity to go out with them was huge, and I was so pumped. And it was first Recon, Charlie Company, and those guys were shit hot then, and they always have been. And they'd already been in country for about 3 or 4 months. And we went out to a little place called Trek Nawa outside of Marja and did some sweep up stuff. And I rolled up a couple fighters, and I think I really just showed them what I could do, the Recon guys. And after that first kind of month long operation, that they brought me in, you know, full time to be their head guy and into the company. And we came back to Leatherneck for a little break for about 2 weeks, and we started getting briefed on Sangin and where, you know, what Sangin was going to look like. And that was the first time I saw those guys nervous, because everything we were hearing about Sangin was really scary. And 3-5, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines was having a really tough time down in the district center, and they were losing a lot of guys. And we were going to be inserting, you know, at night right in the middle of, like, there was no base. There was nowhere for us to go. We were going to have to make our own base. So anyway, we inserted and just filled sandbags and fortified this little compound as best as we could. And spent a solid week just under constant attack. And in between defending ourselves and just trying to hold that little piece of ground, I'd spot this little funny dog trotting around our compound. And he was you see a lot of dogs over there. And from what I'd seen in Helmand, you didn't want to get anywhere near him. But this dog was just instantly kind of different. He stood out in the best way. He had this big head and these goofy legs and kind of trotted around with all this really unexplainable confidence, you know. And after things calmed down, those guys, I mean, at any given moment during a firefight, we'd have 150 to 200 fighters surrounding us. And the best we could have, just because of our position, was maybe 7 or 8 guys returning fire, just because of the way we were kind of, the house we had taken was set up. And I mean, those guys, we didn't lose a single guy.
Wow.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it says a lot about their professionalism. And we came really close. A guy, my buddy Joe, took a round in his helmet, and it spun. It went off his rifle, and it spun into his helmet and popped out the front.
Oh, wow.
And I just reunited him and Fred. That was really cool. They just saw each other in Denver. But anyway, it was insane.
Yeah.
And the recon killed a lot of Taliban, and they kind of gave us a little breathing room. And after things calmed down, you know, I was like, all right, I got to check this dog out. He's too cool, man. And so I started walking over to him, and I had a little piece of beef jerky in my hand. And as I got close to him, I was like, this is a bad idea, because he's covered in bugs and he's hot and hungry and like clearly has been neglected. I was like, this is why we have this rule. You're not supposed to approach the strays. Like, this is stupid. But I took another step or two closer, and then I just heard this little whap, 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 whap kind of coming from him. And I looked up, and he's wagging his tail. And I was like, whoa, that was the last thing I thought he'd do, because he had nothing to wag his tail about. You know, he's probably only about 10 months old, which is old enough for a dog to become kind of nasty, you know, and he clearly never been taken care of, or definitely never been hand fed anything in his life, you know. And anytime anybody had approached him, it probably was just to throw something at him or just shoo him away. And here he is wagging his tail at me. And he surprised me again, because I knelt down and handed the jerky out to him, and he takes it like with his front teeth, just as gently as he can. And I swear, if he had a napkin, he would have wiped his mouth. Like, he just had the best manners. Like, even the best behaved dog back home will like take a ring off your finger for a piece of jerky, you know. And here he is, like, just very gently and peacefully and politely, like, accepting this little piece of jerky. And he followed me back to my this is how he gets his name, which is kind of funny too. I stood up and started walking back, because I didn't want to push it, you know. I didn't want to push it too far. And I felt this little poke in my heel, and he's following me, and one of my buddies is like, hey, looks like you made a friend. But what I heard was, hey, he looks like a Fred. So I was like, yeah, we'll call him Fred. And after that, he was in, man. All the recon guys fell in love with him, even our master sergeant, you know, and all the leadership. Like, they loved him. And it was clear from day one that, you know, he was kind of waiting for us. He was kind of supposed to be there, you know, for us, and we were supposed to be there for him. And but it was getting him home was tricky. And as many times as I've told the story, it still gives me anxiety. And sometimes, well, I just look at him and I'm like, I can't believe got you back.
Yeah. Before we get into getting him home, cause I do want to hear about that, I'm just wondering, did any of the higher ups give you any crap about, like, you know, why do you have this dog? Or
no? Well, yeah, no, nobody from recon said, don't do it. You know, like, they didn't say do it, because, you know, they had. And when I called my commanding officer on my sat phone back at Leatherneck and was like, hey, like, I just want to give you a heads up. Like, you know, we're getting pretty cozy with this little dog out here. He's really cool. And, you know, if it works out, I might try to sneak him back and get him home. And he just took a big sigh and was like, look, man, like, if you get caught, you're on your own. But, like, I'm not going to tell you you can't. You know, like, I'm rooting for you, but I'm not going to go to bat for you. Like, that's as good as permission to me. Like, sure. That was all I needed to hear, you know? So no, nobody really from the recon community or Charlie Company or my CEO, nobody told me we couldn't, but they didn't exactly give me direct permission, which is, in the intel world, that's as good as it gets.
I'd assume you must have always been a dog lover to, you know, just do something like that.
Yeah, I've always been a dog lover, but Fred is actually my first dog.
Wow.
I got the classic, you know, I'm gonna end up walking it kind of thing from my dad when I was a kid. So I had an older sister, and she wanted cats, so we were a cat family. And cats are great. I'm not shitting on cats. I love our cats.
Yeah, it's not the same, though.
But I know it's not the same. And I would intentionally make friends with kids in my school that had dogs, because I would just want to go over to their house and hang out with their dog. And I actually bought a leash with my own money, and I would walk all the neighborhood dogs for free after school, because I was trying to show my dad, like, look, I can take care of a dog. I can do it. But I think it backfired, because he was like, oh, good. You know, like, he's walking the neighbor's dogs. We don't need to get him one.
That's funny.
But yeah, I've always loved him. And I, you know, Fred, I think I was always supposed to have a dog. I just had to go all the way to Afghanistan to get one.
That's cool. Yeah. So let's get into what you were saying before, bringing him back to America. I'd like to hear about the hassle of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was a big risk. And cause it wasn't like we were static. It wasn't like we were on a fob and that was, you know, where I could have maybe hit him a little bit, or he could have blended in with other dogs while I figured out how to get him home. And we were going back to Leatherneck, which is like a totally different environment. You know, it's almost like garrison. You know, like you, if you're not shaving every day and your uniform's not right, like someone, you're going to hear about it. You know, and I had already gotten in trouble for my mustache, which I was upset about because it was really nice. And, and you know, so I was scared, you know, about taking him back there because in a big way, it felt selfish because, yeah, we loved him, you know, but like it's one of those things where do you love him so much that you're going to kill him? Because if I got caught with him, he'd be put down and I'd get in a lot of trouble, but, you know, that's whatever. But, you know, just the circumstances and the risk were all hit on him, you know. And so ultimately I kind of made it his decision. I had a little conversation with Fred the night before that we were supposed to get picked up. And I was like, if you follow me to the helicopter, if you're not scared off by all the noise and rotor wash and all the craziness, you know, that happens when a helicopter comes down, you actually try to come with us, you know, I'll do my part. I'll have a duffel bag in my pocket and I'll be ready and I'll stuff you in it. And he just woke up from his nap. He's ready now. You like this part? Yeah. I was terrified of it either way. Like, if he didn't come and he ran off, you know, I'd be like, oh, that's it. And I would always be heartbroken for that. But if he came, it was like, holy shit, now I got this huge responsibility to hide this dog and figure out a way to get him home, you know. And
it's not a tiny dog, too.
No, yeah, he's not like he was like a puppy. Yeah, yeah. He's a big guy. He hasn't grown much more since then. But so sure enough, I'm running towards the burn, and it's kind of ended up being like a brownout because the dust just continuously swirled, and we were running just trying to make sure we weren't going to run into the tail rotor just to add some more stress to the situation. And I feel another little poke at my heel and I look down and he's terrified. He's scared out of his mind, but he's coming. And it's clear, like, to me now, like we could have been running into a forest fire. He wouldn't have cared. Like he was going to come with us wherever we went. So, Top, the master sergeant, actually was right behind me. He comes running up and grabs Fred by the scruff of the neck, like it's a milk crate, you know, and he just like lifts him up, and I open the duffel bag and we stuff him in it and we zip it closed and we just tried to make it look, you know, look like gear, and ran up the back of the ramp on the 53, and that was it. We took off. Fred went on a helicopter ride before he ever went on a car ride, and that's kind of the most exciting kind of leg of his journey home. But to me, where the story really gets interesting and awesome is after getting him back to Leatherneck. Cause that's when, people really stepped up from unexpected places in really big ways. You know, I had all these workers that worked for DHL, volunteered to watch him for me when I went back out in the field with recon, cause we were only back for 2 weeks and we were right back out the door. And, you know, I had, you know, that wasn't enough time to figure out how to get him home. And then some PFC that I'd never even met before, kind of acquired tactically a kennel for me to ship him home in, which is insane, you know, cause that's, you know, couldn't have happened at a better time. And just all the, you know, just all the people kind of along the way, there was a British Army vet that helped me, kind of gave him an exam, you know, just to make sure he wasn't sick. And she kind of urged me just to fill out the paperwork and kind of make it look as good as I could, and just ship him home and have him vaccinated and all that stuff when he got home, which I was apprehensive about. I didn't want to send a sick dog home if he had some crazy disease, you know. And she was like, he's the longer it takes, you know, the more likely whatever, if he does have something, it might develop in his system. So if you get him home as quick as you can, and your dad gets vaccinated, then he'll be fine. I was like, okay, that's, you know, that helps. So I just kind of made the paperwork look as good as I could and shipped him home. He beat me home by about 4 months. And my dad's predictions of taking care of my dog came true because my dad picked him up at customs and was walking him around our neighborhood until I got home. So, yeah, I guess dads are always right one way or the other.
Does Fred look significantly different at all than when you first saw him? Because you look at the dog in the car on the cover of your book, and it looks like this beautiful dog. I assume it's a mutt of some type, but almost looks like a golden retriever. And it doesn't look like a dog you would meet on the streets of Afghanistan.
Right. No, I mean, if you look at a picture of like a coochie dog or a dog from Hellman, like you can see a lot of Fred in there. But you can also, if you like, pick a dog and look at Fred and you'll find something similar. I even just mean
cleaning him up though. You know what I mean? When you brought him back.
What's that?
I even just mean cleaning him up though. When you brought him back, getting him groomed, that.
My sister gave him his first bath and like the dirt and stuff was just coming off of him. And he's, I think just dog wise, he's definitely a hound and a shepherd. Cause he's really loud and, kind of stubborn like a hound. And he's actually a really good herder. He would herd goats and sheep and stuff. And he would kind of herd us when we were on patrol. He'd kind of poke us around, when we go on patrols at night and stuff. But, he's definitely just got his gene pool is very, very big.
Did you retire from the Marines at that
point? No, I did. I did 8 and got out. I got out in 2011 when I got back from that deployment.
And at what point did you think to yourself, this is a book, this is a story that needs to be told? Or did anyone approach you?
So I think the idea had always kind of been in the back of my head from very early on, like just getting Fred home. And once I came home and started like just realizing how crazy it was that he made it and that we both made it home, I kind of always maybe fantasized about it, but I never let myself go too far, because I think that's just kind of a condition that veterans have to deal with, I think, in terms of just allowing us to think big, because I think our expectations are always so managed in the military, and you just, you know, anytime you think you're getting somewhere, somebody reminds you, you know, like you got a long way to go, or there's always something that happens that, you know, kind of, it's a continuous kind of mind fuck in the military. And so it was really easy to convince myself that, okay, our story is great, but who doesn't love their story about their dog? Okay. Yeah. He's from Afghanistan, but there's lots of dogs from Afghanistan, you know, and like people managed to get home in Iraq and stuff. And like, why is your story so special? And, you know, and I could just dismiss it really quickly. And it was like, oh, you want to write a book? Like, yeah, like every other veteran wants to write a book. Everybody thinks they're special when they get out, like blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, who do you think you are, you know, and get back to work. And so it was really easy for me to dismiss it until, I left the government. I was working for the government, and I left the government and went back to school. And that's when I got into Georgetown and started writing for school and fell in love with writing again. I think it was one of the only things I was ever really loved about school when I was a kid was writing. And I started writing papers and stuff for school, and I was like, man, I actually like this, you know, even in an academic setting, I really love to write. And then on the weekends, Fred and I would go on hikes, you know, in Virginia and on the Appalachian Trail and stuff. And I would bring a legal pad with me and I would fill it in a weekend, just telling the story in different ways, you know. And the more I wrote, the better I felt, you know. At first it was just kind of this therapeutic thing for me to do. And then I started to tell the story to people on the street, because Fred, people stop me all the time, like, hey, what kind of dog is that? Cause he's such a handsome dude. I started to just tell them, you know, and I think they were expecting like this 30-second answer, but they were getting a 30-minute story about, you know, where I found him and how I got him home. And so it was kind of over a couple of years that I really realized that the story itself is bigger than me. And, you know, if I had it my way, the cover of the book would be like Fred and all the recon guys and the DHL workers and my friend Justin and Sean, you know, who were killed, and like all these incredible people that have come into our lives, you know, cause when you read it, I hope that it's apparent to everyone that, you know, like Fred and I are just the kind of spokespeople for the dog for the story, but it's really just our duty to share it, you know, and to share it in as many ways and as often as we can. And I think once I realized that, it made sense in my head. Once I realized that it wasn't you know, I wasn't being selfish by wanting to share my story.
Not at all.
You know, yeah. It was kind of that condition in my head from being in the military for so long, where you're just supposed to do everything very quietly and not seek any kind of attention or anything like that for it. You know, like that was a big hurdle. You know, and it's just ever since I kind of overcame that, the story has been my main focus, and the more I've focused on it, the more doors have opened, and now that the book has been out for a little while, it's like, man, like people are reaching out to us all the time and telling us what they love about it and why and what it's done for them. And it's almost always an unexpected part of the story, or like just something, you know, that they've applied to their situation in their life, and like something I could have never anticipated, you know. And that's unbelievable for me. That's just such, you know, that's proof to me that it is bigger than me and Fred, and we're not, you know, we're not just out here, you know, it's not just a guy and his dog, like, have, you know, like who wouldn't want to do this, you know?
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it's what we're supposed to do. I think that's all what we're looking for. We're everybody's just looking for what feels right inside, you know, and we kind of have that when we're in the military, and then when we get out, we're looking again. And it took me a while, but I'm really proud, you know, of the struggle, and proud to, you know, to say, you know, this is what we're supposed to be doing.
I think in the current climate in America in general, people are looking for these feel good stories. You don't hear about them, and you don't hear about just great stories like this, and friendship, and the love of, you know, a person and their dog. And these are things that we all relate to. And unfortunately, the news cycle is so negative. So I think it's a nice escape from that.
Yeah, it is. And it, to me, like, it's a feel good story, but it's also like this philosophy that, like, I've applied to my life that Fred has kind of taught me. And I call it stubborn positivity. And because that day when I walked up to him and he was covered in bugs and hot and hungry and had every reason to be an asshole. And like, I would have been like, yep, you're a dog in Afghanistan and you don't know what it is to be a dog in my mind. You know, like, of course you just growled at me, I'm going to walk away. And like, it totally would have made sense in my head if he had done that. But he wagged his tail. And that has made all the difference in his life and mine now. And I think it's those moments in life when we feel like everything is negative around us and we feel like nothing's really going our way and people are letting us down. And, you know, we have all these reasons to be nasty and act out, and people around us would even make excuses for us, like, oh, you know, like something happened to them and that's why they're mean or that's why they're doing this. Those are the moments that it's most important for us to wag our tails, you know, or to just do something nice for someone else. You know, and I always just think about in Sangin and in, you know, back here at home or anywhere in the world, when there's a natural disaster, you see really bad stuff and you see negative stuff all the time, but you also see the best of people.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved about my time in Afghanistan, was like watching these recon Marines just be incredible and watching these villagers do incredible things for one another and for us, you know, in these really hard circumstances. So I think it's really easy to get buried today in all this craziness. We're so divided. We're so different.
Yeah.
Our country's, you know, so toxic, but, we have way more in common with one another than the news would have us believe. And it just takes a second to see that. It just takes like a quick hello to your neighbor in the elevator, or holding a door for someone at the grocery store, you know, or just a little thing, you know, and it can reverse your entire day.
Yeah.
And it can reverse somebody else's entire day, and that continues on and on and on. So it's like, yeah, like these positive stories don't get reported because I think so many people kind of like write them off as like feel good, you know, like when you see the local news and it's like, oh, this old lady plays bingo every day, and like, you know, like this sweet old lady, you know, or something like that. It's just kind of fluff. But like, that old lady kicks ass, you know, and she's sweet and she's consistently awesome, you know, and it's those kind of things that make us smile, but we should think a little bit more about them, you know, and try to find a way for us to kind of be more like that. And that's kind of what I've done with Fred, is really overanalyze his life and the way he was when I first met him, and really thought deep and hard about the fact that he wagged his tail, you know, and thought about how I can apply that to my life. And it's insane. It's insane. The, cause I was super negative for the first couple of years when I got out. And you know, there was some bad times there, cause it was just really frustrating. And I felt like I was really validated in being negative. And that's why I call it stubborn positivity, because it's not like this. It's not like this, like, naive, like, sure, like, oh, everything's fine. Meanwhile, your house is on fire and you're just like, oh, everything's positive and great. It's like you really have to embrace the shit and embrace the negative. And then when you do that and you figure out, you know, all the bad things that are going on in your life, then you can find the good. And that's your way out. And it's just little steps, but then they become bigger and bigger and bigger. And I'm rambling now. But
no, I love it, though, because I think what this is all about is how one very small action can change the outcome of not just this dog's life, who would have just been, you know, traveling through Afghanistan, no owner, probably die young at some point, malnourished or something, but also change the outcome of your life, because you, based on what you're saying to me, you didn't see yourself becoming an author or a best-selling author at this point, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's given me, just by that little action, you know, he's given me so much. And I'm more who I was before I joined the Marine Corps than I ever have been. And it's not that I've, like, lost any of my Marine-ness or, like, you know, tried to put it behind me. It's like, almost like, I become the best of both. And like my Marine Corps time and all my experiences, the good and the bad, I've been able to finally stitch together with the confident, kind of goofy, you know, loving kid that I was before the war and before Marine Corps and all that stuff. And it's like, that is what makes me feel really powerful. And I think if there's one thing, if there's any vets or anybody that's listening, you know, like that's what I'm really proud to say, is that, you know, you don't have to, like, try to shut a door on your military, you know, service or experiences. Like, you can, they're valuable, and you don't have to, also, you don't have to have had, like, this sexy, you know, like, spooky deployments with lots of combat and salty shit. Like, you could, like, anybody that's served in any branch, anywhere, like stateside or overseas, your experience is yours, and it's unique and it's awesome. And when you get out, or if you stay in, it's always going to be something that you can use. And I think a lot of times we're told to try and put stuff behind us or not talk about it, you know, and I don't, for me, that hasn't worked. And what's really worked is finding that balance and kind of synchronizing my past and, you know, my present. And that's, you know, I'm on the road right now, so I'm like very philosophical, but you know, it's fun to think about, because if you'd have told me just like 2 years ago that I'd have a book, you know, two books, and we'd be traveling around the country, you know, and people would be like, people recognize Fred all the time. They don't recognize me. Nobody cares about me, but, and you know, like, it's just insane, man. And I'm so grateful to so many people. And I just want to give as much of that to my fellow veterans and everyone, you know, that I can, because I'm seeing it pay off and dividends when we find reasons to be positive. And it's huge.
Well, you know what's crazy about doing this podcast, Craig, is like I hear certain things said by different guests, and I realize that it's echoed by other people in the community. And you know, you've never even heard the interview, but like Leo Jenkins, who was on with us, just did this Verses and Curses tour where he's with fellow veterans reading poetry.
Yeah. I follow that tour on it. I want to meet those guys. They sound awesome.
I met them all, but Leo, I know in particular, and is a great guy. Has been on the show many times, but the last time Leo was on, he pretty much said exactly the same thing as you about, like, if you're a veteran, no matter what your experience, write that shit. Don't, you know, don't keep it bottled up inside. that's not the way of going about things. And like people want to hear your story. And it's just, it's cool when I hear different guests from different walks of life, different branches of the military echo that same type of sentiment.
That's great, man. Yeah. I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm glad that we're shifting the culture in terms of just being a veteran, you know, and, you know, we don't like everybody has that uncle or maybe a father or a family member that's like, oh, that's, you know, my Uncle John, he was in World War II. He doesn't talk about it. You know, like that's, we don't have to be like that, you know, and it's your duty as the carrier of these stories to share them, you know, and it's a burden at times, but it's one worth bearing, you know, and it doesn't have to be easy. It doesn't have to, you know, I think sometimes I can make it look a little easy for people because I love to do it so much, but it's, I mean, we were at a library event in Colorado and I don't know anyone in Colorado. Not I have some friends here, but they're there. But like, it's not like I have family there. Like, this is our first event with the book, like coming way west, you know. And I'm like sitting there with Fred, getting ready to give my talk, and I'm watching the room fill up to like capacity.
Wow.
And like it was hard, man. Like it was hard because I'm just like, holy crap! Like this isn't, you know, in Maine or DC where we're from, you know. And like this is another part of the country and like people are coming, you know, and that was a tough one. I broke down a couple times sharing the story that night. And it's just because it's, you know, it just means so much to me. And I, you know, so it's, you know, it's not an easy kind of pass, you know, it's going to be hard, but it's always worth sharing, and listening to other people's stories. So I'm glad that Verses and Curses tour is so cool. The poetry and stuff, that's some real writing. I'm just sharing stories here. Those guys are real artists. It's
awesome. I got to go to the New York date and it was a great time. And actually I feel like the guys from your generation, like Leo, are inspiring the old generation that you're talking about to get out there and tell their stories. I mean, for example, Jim West was there, who's Special Forces legend in the community, who's become a friend of mine over the years. But the fact is, Jim really did not share any of his story until many, many years later. He kept a lot of it very hidden, was a very angry guy. And, you know, when he talks about his history of getting into bar fights and stuff like that, I think a lot of it is the result of post-traumatic stress issues. And then on top of that, his son being brutally murdered, which he, you know, talks about with us now. But he finally is able to get out there, tell his story in as brutal of terms as he wants, because it's a pretty harsh story, and is now like at peace. And the Jim West that I know in recent years is a guy who like comes up to you and puts his arm around you and has a huge smile on his face. And at least from what he tells me, that is not the Jim West of 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. It's just, it seems so simple that so many of us will write it off, but if you just take one step and you just share your story once, or even a fraction of your story once, you'll see how good it can be. And that's awesome. I'm so glad for him, because that, man, like I talked to a lot of Vietnam guys and it's like, man, like we didn't feel welcomed home.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, I think their thank you for your service is like, welcome home. And so whenever I meet a Vietnam vet, I always try to say, welcome home.
Sure.
To them, that's like their, you know, like they didn't hear that, you know, and that's crazy. I can't imagine going through what I did in Afghanistan and coming home to an environment like that.
And therapy, you know, therapy and all that was not what it is today. It was not, you weren't looked at as like a strong man if you had to see a therapist or talk about your issues, which today I think more and more people are coming out and saying, hey, this is normal. It's something that you should do.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yep. It's awesome.
I was wondering with the book itself. So when you got the book done, for people who don't know, this book is selling incredibly on Amazon. I mean, that's how I came about it. This is not a book that you put out independently. It's through HarperCollins. So what's the story about getting hooked up with them and putting out a book on a major imprint?
Yeah. So it came down to, I wrote 90% of it. And a couple times, and until I had the right one, the right version. And then I put together a proposal, and, you know, just, it's a lot of research and finding comparable books and really just it's a pitch, with a couple of good sample chapters in there. And I had it all lined up, ready to go. What I was missing was something, something to kind of light a spark, you know, and kind of shine a light on our story. You know, I had I had Fred's Instagram going, Fred the Afghan, and all that stuff. It was all the foundation was built. But I needed just somebody to kind of shine a light on us and so attract the attention of a publisher. Because it's not like, you know, when a celebrity writes a book, like the publishers just give, you know, like come crawling to them or something like that. So anyway, I was reaching out to like news organizations and like different online kind of organizations like Upworthy and stuff like that. And I wasn't getting anywhere. Nobody was really interested. One local news channel in D.C. actually told me to get back to them at Veterans Day, which was a total kick in the dick. and just because it's like, really, like you want to just run this. Okay. And so, I was kind of frustrated and, it was actually I got out of Georgetown, I graduated and I got a job offer from Booz Allen and I was going to go work, you know, in the back to the government. And I had 8 months to figure out, I had 8 months until my clearance would be reinstated. And I was like, all right, I got 8 months to get this book off the ground. If that's what I'm supposed to do, it'll happen in the next 8 months. And I have a fundraiser every year for my friend Justin, who was killed. And we do it in D.C. We do it at a bar called The Pug. And then we I'm in like a mediocre cover band. And we hold down a two-hour set at this place called the Rock and Roll Hotel, which is down the street. And we raise money for TAPS, which is a great nonprofit for grief counseling to the families of the fallen. And
what do you Justin, play in the cover band, by the way?
I'm the drummer.
Nice. Yeah.
Make noise. And Justin's mom and dad come down from Pittsburgh and we pack the house. It's an incredible night. But my polygraph was scheduled for the morning after. And that was not going to happen. And they wouldn't let me reschedule it. But like, I mean, me and Justin's dad like drink like a lot. And it's just a great night. But it was not the kind of night that you could recover from in a day. So at one point during the night, I was kind of like, man, I'm not going. I'm not going to that polygraph. You know, and that was a big choice because I was struggling. You know, if my girlfriend Nora was like holding us down with her job, she moved down from Boston and was working a tech job, you know, in D.C. And I was working retail, you know, while I was waiting for my clearance to go through. So it was like that, and just that was the rational path, like going back to the government and taking that contractor job. And but it was some point in the night, you know, maybe my ninth or tenth shot of Jameson, I was like, I'm not going to this polygraph tomorrow, you know, and it made sense. And my girlfriend was Nora. She was like, yeah, like, you know, it's okay. And I found, not the next day, because I didn't do anything the next day, but the day after that, I found this website called The Dodo. And it's all positive animal stories. It's all, like, uplifting, awesome stories that are related to animals. And I shot them an email and, like, kind of forgot about it. I was like, they won't get back to me because I was kind of used to getting rejected. And I think like an hour later, I got an email back and was like, hey, we want to do an interview, write an article. And wow, you have all this social media videos and pictures. Like, can we make a video? I was like, whoa. So I got on the phone with this girl and her name was Sarah. And I gave her like the hour long version of Fred's story and sent her all these pictures and let them upload everything they wanted from my YouTube channel and Fred the Afghan Facebook and Instagram. And they put together this video. And it got like 20 million views in like 48 hours.
That's got to be overwhelming.
Yeah. And I got an email from a senior editor at HarperCollins and we were off and running.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Everything just happens the way it's supposed to, I guess.
Yeah. You know, but fate. It's like if I had been who I was in the years prior, I would have made a lot of excuses for myself. And been kind of negative about getting rejected and being like, well, I guess I'm not supposed to do that, you know, and it would have been really easy to kind of give up. But it's really just comes down to stubborn positivity and finding, you know, like that drive and to continue to, you know, just look for what you're supposed to do instead of just settling.
That's awesome, man. Well, I'm sure a lot of the audience is going to want to pick up the book. There's a huge cross section of, you know, military and dog lovers in this audience. So the book is Craig and Fred, a Marine, a stray dog, and how they rescued each other. Of course, as we mentioned before, there's also the Young Readers Edition if you have a kid in the audience, which a lot of our audience does. On Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Fred the Afghan, fredtheafghan.com. And I guess from what you're saying, you're on like a book signing tour.
Yeah. Oh, hang on. Fred wants to say
Okay.
So what dates do you have coming up? Because if, you know, some people listening might want to meet you.
Yeah.
Meet Fred, of course.
We're adding stuff all the time. We're traveling across the country right now. June 30th, we're going to be in Pasadena. And that's the way it usually goes. I go to a library or a bookstore, and I share the story for you know, about 40, 45 minutes, and then I answer questions. People always have great questions. And then I sign books. We have a little potograph that we made out of Fred's paw.
Nice.
And we signed the books like that. And it's just, the events are really a lot of fun. And that's really great to meet so many people. People, you can check our website on the event. We're always adding new events. So if you just go to fredtheafghan.com and go under events, you'll see the Pasadena thing and all the details there. And then we're hoping to get more, you know, while we're out west. If anything pops up, we haven't said no yet to just about any library or bookstore.
Nice.
We do speak in a lot of schools too, when schools are in session. And, wants to look into having us, you know, we're easy to find. And we love traveling, and we love sharing our stories. So
it's funny you mentioned the podograph. Mike Ritland, who's been on the show, Navy SEAL, canine instructor. Andrew Wilkow, who used to work with, might have been the first who got him to do it. But I think he'll sometimes have his dog bite the book.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, I bet I could get Fred to do that.
Yeah.
We'll have to try that. Yeah.
Well, thanks that's for awesome. Coming on, man. I was going to tell you before we wrap this up, part of what we do at Hurricane Group, we're working with this company, Kuna Dog, and we have like a monthly dog subscription box where we're sending out like probiotics, toys that are geared towards like the specific dog you have in terms of weight and all that. So I would love to get you hooked up with them. I think I told your publicist we'll send you over some stuff, but like naturally me just thinking of this, I was like, Craig would be a perfect ambassador for this. So maybe we could make something happen.
That'd be awesome, man. Yeah. We would be interested in hearing more and just seeing what you guys have in mind. I'd love, she mentioned something briefly about it, but we've been in and out of reception the last couple of days. So it's, I haven't looked into it too much, but yeah, I'd love to. We haven't partnered with any brands or anything like that yet, but it's something that we've been interested in. We've just wanted to wait for the right, you know, the right opportunity. So
very cool, man. Well, send me over, you know, through her, or you could send it to me. Send me over your address, and I'll make sure that the people who work on that portion of the website could send you over some gear and see how you like it, see how Fred likes it, of course.
It's all about Fred. Cool.
Very cool, man. Well, it's been awesome having you on. I don't want to keep you too long because I know you got your dog in the car. But
we got the air. He's taking a nap. He's chilling.
Nice. Well, I think people are going to dig this, man. And I love the story, and it's very different than any of the other stories out there.
Oh, man, that's good. I appreciate you saying that, man. I appreciate the time. We love doing it. So yeah, and if anybody has any questions, you know, or anything like that, you can go to the website and send us a contact form. You know, I do my best to chase them down and answer any questions people have. And we try to be easy to find. So thank you for just giving us a chance to share it with your audience. We love doing that.
That's awesome. Thanks, Craig. It's been a pleasure. Man, great guy, which is exactly what I was expecting. I mean, it's just such an awesome story. Hopefully a lot of you in this audience pick that up. And hopefully I can get Craig on board with some stuff we're doing at Kuna Dog. I think that'd be really awesome to get him as some type of ambassador for the club. I know we have Tim Kennedy and all those guys putting stuff out there. But this book is doing great in terms of sales. And it's just great to see. Like I said, in a news cycle of just negative things going on, I think people like to hear a positive story like this. And people love their dogs. You know, when I worked at Sirius XM, like any story, any show that involved, like there was a pet psychic show, which I believe is still on the air, like phone lines would pack out immediately. And it was just evidence of just people love their dogs in America and I think throughout the world. And I get it. As I've said before, and you guys are probably tired of me saying it, I need to get a dog. I haven't had a dog in many years. I did have a Lakeland Terrier named Marley. who passed away quite some time ago. And I think it's about time I get a new dog. So I've been looking into that. Jack Murphy will be back next episode. And we're going to be in studio with Todd Apolsky. I should mention before we wrap this up, though, or as we wrap this up, rest in peace to Vinnie Paul from Pantera, man. I got to see Pantera on their last ever tour during the Extreme Steel Tour, and, like, what a night that was. It was Pantera, Slayer, Static X, Scrape, and Morbid Angel, so that's a killer lineup. NASA Coliseum, pre-9/11, and I was pretty young back then, man, so I'm one of the few people my age who got to see Pantera live, and it's just, you know, we all know what happened to Dimebag Darrell, and I think we all felt like we'd be seeing Vinnie Paul put out more music with Hell Yeah and any other project for years to come, and he's no longer with us, and I know, like, Pantera is one of those bands for you guys who've been deployed, like, it is the soundtrack for war for a lot of you, I mean, because of just the brutality of it and the anger and aggression, and, you know, for me, it's great. Gym music, it's been the soundtrack to a lot of times in my life. So rest in peace to one of the great drummers and a guy that everybody who's ever met him seems to have nothing but great things to say about the type of guy that he was, where, you know, he loved to drink with people, cook for people, and just have an all-around great time. I mean, people who I used to work with, like Jose Mangan, couldn't speak more highly of Vinnie Paul. So rest in peace to him. And that's about it for this episode. You could follow me on Twitter and all that. I haven't been doing as much social media lately, but at Ian Scotto, facebook.com/IanScottoRadio. I have some new things on the horizon, I think. And once those happen, I'll get the information out there. But I've been, you know, living in the moment and off of social media for the most part. So if people want to hear me, in any virtual capacity, it's really just through this podcast as of lately. We've been posting all the great stuff happening here on the social media for this. So at SopRep Radio on Instagram and Twitter. We love the feedback. Keep the reviews coming on Apple Podcasts. And we'll see you again Friday with a brand new episode. Peace.
You've been listening to SopRep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. For all of the great content from our veteran journalists, join us and become a Team Room member today at SoftRep.com. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at SoftRep Radio. And be sure to also check out the Power of Thought podcast, hosted by Hurricane Group CEO and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, Brandon Webb.